In Alan Walker's anthropological survey of the key mining town of Cessnock that he wrote at the end of the Second World War, he interviewed a whole series of people, figures from the town, and one anonymous miner gave his account of the Depression, which I thought summed up the experience so much for so many workers. This anonymous miner said, "Until 1929, things were good. I remember earning over £500 a year, and I thought I was going to be a millionaire someday. Then came the crash, and I realised I was living in a fool's paradise. The Depression woke me up. I saw the system was wrong, and I became interested in politics." And I think, like I said, this quote, I think, sums up the experience of so many hundreds of thousands of workers during the Depression. And the Depression was a fairly cataclysmic event for working class life, to say the least. It destroyed several key unions, it reduced hundreds of thousands of workers to living in shanty towns, and made industrial timidity the order of the day. And yet, by the beginning of the Second World War, there was a rising level of industrial militancy, and workers were really beginning to flex their muscles and engage in sort of more aggressive strike action. So in 10 years, this whole situation of devastation had been turned around. And so how did this happen? How do you go from what the Federated Ironworkers, one of the unions I'm going to be talking about during the course of my talk, whose branch had less than 30 members in Wollongong in 1931 and had largely survived the Depression because it was affiliated to the arbitration system, actually managed to, at the end of 1945, at the end of the war, engage in a strike where the leadership of the Federated Ironworkers seriously flirted with the idea of being permanently deregistered and operating outside the arbitration system. They didn't do it, but they were certainly considering it. And I think the common thread throughout this entire story is from the most miserable days of the Depression to the class battles of the Second World War was the Communist Party. Because out of the crucible of the Depression, the Communist Party was able to build a serious working-class following that propelled many of its members into the leadership of key industrial unions. But, of course, the sting in the tail is that while the Communist Party attracted some of the most dynamic militants and had really showed the potential to build a serious fighting force that could have really made something out of the late 1930s, and then I think the situation at the end of the war, this potential was squandered. The Communist Party's Stalinist politics eventually end up playing a role stifling working class militancy and rank and file action, and it did a lot to squander some of the militancy that it helped to create. So this talk is going to try and address that particular story, and it will focus on the miners and the Federated Iron Workers. Of course, this does an enormous injustice to the other unions that went through this whole process during the Depression, like the wharfies, the seamen, the railway workers, but space doesn't allow me to cover them, and I think just trying to focus on two will help draw out some of the dynamics and the relationship between the Communist Party and the rebuilding of the unions. Let's look at the Depression, because I think to understand how things are rebuilt, we also have to understand the nature of their destruction. And the Depression in Australia hit quite reasonably early, and even before the Great Crash in 1929, there was skyrocketing unemployment and several key industries in Australia were on the verge of collapse. With the onset of the crisis proper in the late 1920s, there were three critical disputes involving the miners, the timber workers and the waterside workers, and each of these struggles involved the imposition of new wage cuts as the bosses sought to shore up their profits as the economy started to go down the tubes. And each group of workers went down to a dismal and harrowing defeat. The timber workers and the waterside workers' unions virtually collapsed after their defeat, as the bosses' victory ensured that scab unions and scab labour would be able to be used in these industries. The miners fought a bitter and protracted battle over 16 months in the northern coalfields, resisting the imposition of a 20% wage cut. And the strike culminated in a virtual military occupation in northern New South Wales, where there were riots and confrontation with the police, and where the police actually murdered a miner at Rothbury. The miners were forced back to work with a 12.5% wage cut, and this was the so-called compromise that the Arbitration Commission had imposed. And during the miners' strike, the federal Labor government under Scullin had been elected under the promise of being able to get the miners back to work, and with some sort of promise that they would do something to equally punish or the bosses who had flouted a lot of the rules and regulations during the lockout. Needless to say, upon election, Scullin did not make good on any of the promises, didn't get the miners back to work in a satisfactory way. I think that this, you know, really started to lay the basis for a bitterness and anger and hostility directed towards particularly the federal Labor Party on the part of the miners. But these key defeats at the end of the 20s and going into the early 30s were decisive in opening up further a more wholesale attack on the working class when the Arbitration Court imposed a 10% across the wage, a 10% across the board wage cut in 1931. And of course, so if you were lucky enough to have a job in the Depression, you were facing, massive wage cuts as well as, you know, increases in the rate of exploitation more generally. As well as this was coupled with massive growth of unemployment. And the figure that gets quoted in most of the history books is there was 30% unemployment during the Depression. But pretty much every historian I've read of the period suggests that this figure was actually an understatement. And certainly when you see the figures that are provided in Robin Golan's book about the miners, he says that out of 24,000 miners working in New South Wales around the time of the beginning of the Depression, so around 10,000 lost their jobs between 1927 and 1931. So that's actually close to half. So you get a sense then of the absolute devastation that unemployment wrought in the working class. So the whole situation facing workers going into the early part of the 1930s was summed up in a miners' union report of 1931 called, aptly, Review of Position. The report acknowledged the disintegration which had already taken place and admitted that 40% loss of membership. It regarded any attempt to enforce the payment of levies to the federal body as futile, so maintaining their affiliation to the federal miners' union, and that districts were in future to finance their own stoppages, and which were, as a general rule, to be avoided. So you can sort of see that intimidity and avoidance of all kinds of conflict was the general order of the day, particularly for the for workers, but particularly that was the attitude that the miners' union leadership took. And I think the question of stoppages and what role strikes could play in terms of trying to resist the attacks of the Depression became a very important one for workers, particularly as they nursed their defeat and began ruminating on the lessons of the great defeats of the late 20s and early 30s. And a key feature of all of the disputes had been debates within the unions about what was the appropriate strategy to deal with the attacks. There was a growing minority of militants within the unions that considered limited stoppages as too timid and demanded a more militant strategy of all-out stoppages, but either within their own industry or even more, grander scale of, across several industries in response to the attacks of the Depression. So, for example, in the lead-up to the lockout in the northern coalfields, which the miners' strike I've already referred to, there was a big debate within the union, and a motion to have an all-out strike was only narrowly defeated by the leadership. So I think then you get to start to see the beginnings of the sort of radicalisation and a section of the working class wanting to go on a more militant footing in response to the desperation and attacks of the Depression. And this is, I think, the reason why some of these militants were increasingly drawn to the Communist Party, because as I said before, the Australian working class faced a very bleak picture at the beginning of the 30s. Its organisations lay in ruins, unemployed workers had been pushed to the very margins of society, and fascist organisations were growing everywhere. So the Communist Party's anti-capitalist rhetoric and revolutionary calls fitted with the worldview of thousands and thousands of workers. So I want to turn now to look at the role of the Communist Party in this early period of the Depression. Thank you. Because I hope my fairly brief and by necessity in terms of time, quite schematic overview of the onset of the Depression gives you some sense of the political situation facing the Communist Party and what they were grappling with. By the late 1920s, the Communist Party had hundreds of members, somewhere between 200 and 300 members. But during the Depression, they grew substantially. So by 1931, they could boast 2,500 members. As their radical anti-capitalist rhetoric was becoming more and more appealing as the effects of the Depression deepened. And equally, they had a number of members placed in key unions where their arguments for militancy had also gained quite a hearing. Their key strategy at this time was was a follow-on from a strategy that had been articulated as early as 1923 when the Comintern directed the Communist parties in countries like Australia to form rank-and-file groups within the unions. And this is where the Militant Minority Movement, or MMM, or I'm just going to call it the Movement for this during the course of this talk, was born. And after a fitful start, the Communist Party was actually able to organise a conference of militants in 1929, and this involved both Communist Party members and others who were not members but cohered around the Communist Party. And the movement's aims were proclaimed in its journal. It published a regular journal called the Red Leader, and it proclaimed its aims thus: to increase the power of organised labour by promoting class consciousness, to develop among workers a spirit of dependence on their own collective strength as a means of forcing concessions from capital and defence against attack, to assist the development of the working class movement towards the overthrow of capitalism and for the socialisation of industry. And you can see immediately how this would have appealed to workers stinging from the defeats of and the effects of the Depression. The movement strategy involved an orientation to rank-and-file initiative and resisting the boss's attacks and fighting to improve wages and conditions, combined with seeing these struggles at the shop floor level as part of a much bigger struggle to abolish capitalism and create socialism. And for thousands of workers, it was an electrifying mix. However, the caveat we have to place on all of this was that the proper establishment and the big, origins of the militant minority movement in the late 20s also occurred during what is now known as the third period in terms of the direction the Comintern was giving to the communist parties around the world. And it had a particular sort of lunatic quality to it in terms of its attitude it took to other key forces within the working class. And the imposition of the third period was part of the Stalinisation of the party, where under directions from the Comintern, the party was purged of, dissenters, and leaderships that were sort of loyal to carrying out the Comintern line were imposed, along with very bureaucratic, centralised and top-down methods of organising, and that the political line that came from Russia was obviously designed to suit the interests of a new ruling class emerging in Russia. But in the context of 1929, the movement line was that they rigidly adhered to was a doctrine of social fascism. And this was the idea that the ALP was the actual left-wing, ALP being, in the end, pro-capitalist party, which is true, but because they were pro-capitalist, that they were actually, in effect, the left-wing of the fascism, or as the Communist Party called them, the social fascists. And that meant that all the members, all the trade union leaders, all the parliamentarians, everyone in the Labour Party was to be condemned as part of the growing fascist menace. So as tens of thousands of workers flooded into the socialisation units that had been created in the early 1930s out of the Labour Party, the CP denounced them. And when the Premier of New South Wales, Lang, was dismissed for defying the British banks and refusing to repay the interest on the loans and refusing to impose some of the wage cuts that were part of the austerity plan of Scullin, and that hundreds of thousands of workers rallied around Lang to try and protest his sacking, the Communist Party also denounced them as left social fascist. So you can see that there's obviously problems with their orientation. But I think the important thing to point out here, though, is that in an Australian context where there were federal and state Labor governments imposing, and particularly the federal government imposing austerity upon workers. I mean, Lang, just before he was sacked, had finally agreed to some of the austerity measures, so it wasn't, but that's just an aside. Coupled with the general viciousness of the Depression, the CP's anti-Labor rhetoric, the social fascism, could actually have an appeal and actually cohere the sort of hardcore of militants who were just absolutely frustrated and fed up with the conservatism of the ALP. And this is particularly the case in unions like the miners and the iron workers, where some of the officials had been associated with the Labor Party and the general conservative line about, industrial timidity rather than trying to take on the bosses to defend workers against the attacks of the Depression. And so, for example, by 1932, there was a growing number of branches of the minority movement operating in the iron workers, and their general attacks on the iron workers' leadership would go something like this. And this is just an example, but this is generally how the movement sort of positioned themselves in the unions during this period. So this is the Red Leader would proclaim the usual, that would lambast the union officials as the usual reactionaries and just not militant enough to cope with BHP, who was seen as a sort of big bogey representing all of the horrors of capitalism, and stifling struggle and promoting inactivity and passiveness on the part of the rank and file, which could only lead to disintegration and disorganisation of the union, leaving us prey to the owning class. And you can certainly see how this kind of rhetoric would appeal to the militants. But the CP applied this sort of barrage in a totally undifferentiated way. And so, and actually in the Federated Iron Workers, this became a bit of a block to them capturing some of the positions early on, because some of the officials in the FIA had actually had been part of the general strike during the end of the First World War, had been associated with the Wobblies and had quite an authority of, you know, being left-wing militants on their own. And so attacking them in this sort of undifferentiated way actually, I think, probably alienated some workers. And certainly it alienated the leadership of some of the unions, and, you know, Communist Party militants found themselves being banned, prevented from going to some of the mass meetings and things like that because of this stance that they took. So they sort of helped cut them off in some ways from some workers. However, by 1932, the movement had grown and could claim around 3,000 members. And in Stuart McIntyre's book on the Communist Party, I think he's a little dismissive of this 3,000 figure, because, I mean, in world historic terms, it's not that big. But when you think about, you know, how much the political situation you imagine today would be transformed if there was 3,000 militants of any, you know, cohered around a particular party and prepared to operate and to argue for a more militant strategy in the union, how much that would make a difference. And I think that you can see just in that small nucleus around that 3,000 that it did start to have quite an effect. Another element to the minority movement's work was their work amongst the unemployed. I don't really have that much time to go into it. Suffice to say that their work amongst the unemployed was quite important in terms of their later successes in the union, because a lot of their leading organisers and members cut their teeth in organising the unemployed workers' movement, which was the organisation that the minority movement was associated with. And it was a crucial recruiting ground for the communists. And like I said, many of their future leaders of the miners and the iron workers cut their teeth in this movement. So particularly, keep in mind a person called Pat McHenry. He was a militant involved in the unemployed workers' movement in Wollongong, and that's where he became to prominence, and later on he became an official in the iron workers. But just remember that name, because he'll be important at the end of my talk. And I think that the free speech movements, the fighting the fascists, organising workers who were doing, you know, involved in the government relief, unemployment relief programs, all of these things were critical in building up an authority and a record for the Communist Party and getting the respect and following of thousands of workers during this period. And it was due to this, the other thing that was worth mentioning here before I move on to talking about the rebuilding part. One of, I think, the key elements of the Communist Party strategy was the fact that they tried to not just organise workers to fight and resist the attacks of the Depression, but to those fights they brought a degree of ideological coherence and an anti-capitalist and socialist worldview, which I think was really important in terms of galvanising and cohering the people that they recruited. And so the publications of things like the Red Leader and the little journals and publications that they put out in the unions where the movement was they were involved were really critical, I think, to giving both a theoretical and worldview that helped, I think, inspire and galvanise workers to engage in the various struggles, whether it was on the shop floor or in the unemployed workers' movement. And I think because of these aspects, their work started to pay dividends by 1934, and there was a series of things that happened that sort of started to turn the tide a bit. The first of which was in late 1933, a Communist Party member, William Orr, got elected to the New South Wales branch of the Miners Federation. And this was the first Communist Party official to get elected. And then this coincided with earlier in 1934, when the economy had started to pick up with the coal strike in Wonthaggi, which was actually a victory for the miners in the Victorian town. This also coincided with a shift away from the sort of ultra-left lunacy of the third period to a more sane approach. After Hitler's victory in Germany, the Comintern effectively dumped the third period in favour of a united front against fascism, which was later to then evolve into the out-and-out popular front. But it seemed to be, on the face of it, a return to the Comintern's policy of the 1920s, which is more sort of sensible, and it certainly much more suited the Communist Party and their intervention into the unions as they were beginning to have some influence and gather forces. And certainly, Tom O'Lincoln in his book argues that this having a more sane approach was essential in terms of building on the successes they had, because it's one thing to have this sort of ultra-left thing that can cohere militants in the early part, but once you actually start to have some forces that you can mobilise and bring into the field of battle, well, that's, the ultra-left lunacy wouldn't have suited at all. So these sort of things, conjuncture of events, meant that the Communist Party was in a position to lead the strike in Wonthaggi, effectively, and it was a real, fine example of rank-and-file organising, and that rank-and-file organising contributed very much to its success. So, like I said, the 1934 coal strike was a key turning point for Labor during the Depression. I think key to the strike's victory was the leadership of the strike, which came principally from militants in the Communist Party and the movement. And the movement and the minority movement had captured key positions in the local branch of the union in 1932, and then that led to them being able to be the leadership of the strike. It's interesting to sort of see the political progression in a place like Wonthaggi. Apparently most of the members of the ALP had left around 1930, which then opened up the space for the Communist Party to recruit some of them. Part of the way in which the minority movement led the strike was forming various subcommittees to take up vital tasks such as propaganda. You know, they sent people on speaking tours across the whole country to gather support, political support for the strike. And they also organised a relief committee, which was, raised like tens of thousands of pounds to pay strike pay for the workers. And you can imagine in the context of the Depression, this would have been an essential aspect to the success of the strike. During the course of the strike, the militant minority's paper sold over 500 copies per edition, and I think that gives you some sense of the way in which the militant minority both was organisationally and politically cohering the strike, which I think is quite an essential feature of the role that the Communist Party played in this period. It was Menzies, who was a state minister, because it was a state-run mine that where the strike happened. Eventually, Menzies capitulated and gave the workers their demands, which was had started with disciplining a worker. It also involved clawing back wage losses and things like that. Eventually capitulated, I think precisely because you could see that the strike had the danger of spreading across the country, and that this could be a critical turning point in terms of giving workers more confidence. So they sort of ended the strike to try and head it off in many ways and to stop it from becoming a bigger event. So I want to now just to look at and just draw out some of the points about how the miners in particular managed to rebuild during this period. And like I said, this is a case study, and there's a general contour in terms of the way where the Communist Party intervened, but I just wanted to try and focus on this in a bit more detail. Well, in terms of the miners' success, particularly in New South Wales, the collapse of the Lang government, I think, opened up a space for the left. And because one of the features of the Lang government was that Lang had, over the previous 5 or 6 years of his premiership, built up this incredibly monolithic apparatus that his supporters controlled various parts of the union bureaucracy, various parts of the Labor Party and the branches, and so he had the sort of fairly loyal support base that could support him in the course of his premiership. When it all came to a very sticky end with his sacking, this opened up a space for the Communist Party in terms of being able to make something out of the disarray and disorientation that his sacking and the collapse of his government threw his supporters into. So I think that's a critical juncture in terms of explaining how the Communists managed to end up getting control, particularly the New South Wales branch of the miners first. The other aspect, I think, of their rebuilding was the fact that because they were propelled out of the rank and file, they had a genuine commitment and political commitment and authority and connection with the rank and file that I think was key to their ability to lead the unions in the way that they did. And despite the Stalinisation and the sort of lunatic nature of some of the political things that the Communist Party did, and all the various gyrations imposed from Russia, this commitment and authority with the rank and file, they managed to maintain. I think the other aspect of their ability to rebuild was that they were elected with a really clear agenda, and I think this agenda was important. And the agenda was to try and claw back the losses of the Depression and to try and make gains for the working class at the sort of shop floor level. But also this was tied to a world view, a vision of a different society that these struggles were an intimate and integral part. And I think this is what gave the militants who were around the Communist Party and in the Communist Party such dynamism and verve that they were able to, in terms of being able to inspire others and to continue and to fight, because they saw their small struggles at the shop floor as part of a bigger struggle to get rid of the system as a whole. And I think finally, capturing the miners was important in terms of the successes that the communists had in capturing the leadership of other unions, because the miners, because they had a long tradition, the union had been around since 1860, the union was based in these sort of regional centres a lot, particularly in places like New South Wales, like Cessnock I mentioned at the beginning, where there was a real identity and local kind of association with the miners' union that meant it could be parochial on the one hand, but I think in the context of the Depression it was partly what allowed the miners to hold on to their traditions and kept the space alive for the communists to be able to intervene in the later years. And I think once the miners captured the leadership of the... Well, sorry, once the Communist Party captured the leadership of the miners, that helped lay the basis for capturing other unions. So by 1937, the leadership of the miners, which is now controlled by the Communist Party, launched a Log of Claims campaign. And this Log of Claims campaign reflected their general orientation to the rank and file. They held meetings, pit top meetings and aggregate meetings, branch meetings, all across New South Wales to find out what the grievances, the particular problems of the workers were in order to launch this Log of Claims campaign to claw back some of the losses of the Depression. The Log of Claims campaign was also unique because it circumvented the detested arbitration system. That they, miners' union, laid the Log of Claims directly at the union boss's feet and said, all right, you answer to us about this. And there was an implicit threat in the Log of Claims that we'll have an all-out stoppage if you do not meet some of these claims. And I think precisely because the economy was beginning to pick up, there was a drive, I think, to rearm in the lead-up to the war, that the bosses thought, well, okay, we'll make some of their demands in order to avoid an all-out stoppage. So the fact that the Log of Claims was successful and they were actually able to claw back some of the losses actually really gave the miners a real boost and gave them some real confidence going into 1938. And their editorial in the first edition of Common Cause, which is the Miners' Journal, which is your visual aid, so... I think reflects the sort of confidence and sense of purpose that the union had. So, it said, "In the complete unity of all the forces of the working class lies our sure guarantee for success against the forces of capitalism, and towards such unity we must bend all our energies in 1938. There can be no real freedom politically and economically until capitalism is abolished, and with it the spectre of war. And in 1938, our organisational and educational work must be intensified to hasten the replacement of capitalism with a socialist regime." Now, I think this editorial really sums up the confidence, but also the way in which they tied their work within the union to this broader project of fighting for a socialist society. And I think that, you know, it really, I think it reflects the politicisation of the Depression and the fact that this... you know, this kind of rhetoric found a real audience amongst the miners, the members of the miners' union. And people may notice the TUI's ad in the... Because when I first started doing research into the miners' union and I started looking at their journal, the ads for things like Peter's Ice Cream and TUI's I found quite bizarre. I couldn't really understand, you know, why this had happened. But it's occurred to me, actually, I think the very fact that there's ads for such well-known products in the Miners' Journal reflects two things. Firstly, that they had a readership. There was obviously a readership that the, you know, TUI's and Peter's Ice Cream felt confidence that they could reach through placing advertisements. And secondly, that the miners had money to be able to afford things, particularly like ice cream, which were a bit of a luxury during the Depression. So I think that and I'm sure it also was useful, you know, revenue for the union. I think that even the establishment of the journal, because the Common Cause was restarted in 1935, reflected this general sense of confidence, dynamism and purpose that the Communist Party leadership imbued the union with. The 1937 Log of Claims campaign laid the basis for another Log of Claims campaign in 1938 around the questions of mechanisation that did lead to an all-out stoppage and was also successful. one of the other features of the work that the Communist Party did with the miners during this period was, like, they published a whole series of educational pamphlets about the state of the union, about the threat of mechanisation. They had a whole series of pamphlets like coal, and it was followed up by coal facts and things that were attempt to educate the union members, but also the wider community to support the struggles that the miners were going to engage in. And I think, and even just the journal Common Cause itself plays that role, quite critical role. Okay, so I want to move on briefly to conclude by talking about the war, the sting in the tail of this story, because the impressive achievements that the Communist Party made in the various unions during the Depression, I think, cannot be understated, and it was an impressive achievement, and in many ways we have a lot to thank the Communist Party for being able to rebuild those unions out of their absolute decimation in the early part of the Depression. However, the role that they played during the war, I think, really attests to the problems of their politics, and I think leaves sort of tantalising questions about what could have happened had there been an organisation that wasn't so dominated by the Comintern and the Stalinised politics of Stalinism. So the beginning of the war in 1939 in Australia was a bit of a political non-event. There wasn't the sort of rapturous, you know, parades to support our boys or anything like that. People were still very much seeing from the effects of the Depression, and the war was seen as a conflict happening largely overseas and not particularly in the interests of Australian workers. And so in the first 2 years of the war, there was actually a rising level of strikes as workers regained their confidence as the wartime economy began to improve their industrial position. And I think reflecting some of the sort of general lack of enthusiasm for the war, shall we say, the ACTU didn't take a position on the war until 1940. So it's, I think, almost a year after it began, they declared their uncompromising all-out support. By the beginning of the war, the Communist Party had around 5,000 members, and their growth had really attested to their strengths and abilities to organise during the Depression. But their attitude to the war, first of all, they were confused. Then they adopted a position of calling it an imperialist war, and this was obviously backed up by the campaign that they did throughout their own organisation, the miners and all the rest of it, against the threat of fascism and those kinds of things. So for the first 18 months or so, it was an imperialist war, and they were bitterly opposed to it. However, with the entry of Russia into the war and they switching to the Allied side, the Communist Party became the most ardent proponents of the war and became the leading war party, as historians have referred to them. So by 1932, the Communist president declares, "We have been trained to fight and we have proven our ability, but we must fight militancy with militancy we have shown in all our struggles and just as vigorously. But today we must learn to fight in a new way. We must fight for production." So they wanted to fight to increase production, to rope workers into going all out, because this is a life and death struggle against fascism, and to back up Russia in the war effort. So for the first time ever in the history of the miners, the miners worked on Australia Day in 1942. And the Communist Party went so far as to organise competition between the pits to increase production for the war. So you think about how this really flies in the face of all the things that they've preceded. And there actually was an increase in production during this period. However, across the spectrum of unions led by the Communist Party, the officials found it quite difficult to actually get the rank and file to accept these sort of pro-war class collaborationist policies and increases in production. And that their journal and their internal correspondence is filled with accounts of the difficulties that they encountered in trying to get workers to accept the policies that they were promoting. And I sort of wanted to finish by referring to one strike that happened at the end of the war, which I think sort of sums up the way in which the trajectory of the Communist Party had come full circle. And that's the strike at Mort Dock in Balmain in 1945. And obviously, in world historic terms, it's a fairly small strike. It only involved one branch of the union, the Balmain branch, one of the oldest branches of the ironworkers. But like I said, it's largely symbolic. So in May 1945, there was a 6-week strike against the union carried out by the ironworkers, led by a group of Trotskyists around the figure Nick Oreglass, who at Mort Dock in Balmain. And the Trotskyists were opposed to the war and particularly opposed to the Communist Party's leadership desire to impose these pro-war, pro-production, anti-strike policies. And I think the strike itself reflected the war weariness of many workers. They've been 6 years of this long and bitter conflict. And they were also utterly frustrated with the sort of class collaborationist policies of the Communist Party and the desire of the Communist Party to try and stifle strikes and increase production at all costs. But also the Communist Party, you know, is bureaucratic and quite attempts to try and stifle any dissent within the union, because the strike had started when the the federal leadership had intervened to try and undermine Nick Oreglass and effectively cut him out of being able to have any access to the union. And in order to try and keep control of the Balmain branch, they were forced to rig the union elections, I think, 2 years running, in order to stop the Trotskyists, who were in an alliance with some people from the Labor Party, gaining control of the branch in opposition to the Communist Party. And Pat, it was Pat McHenry, you know, the militant from Wollongong, cut his teeth in the Unemployment Workers Union, who was the one that was sent in to rig the ballot on behalf of Ernie Thornton, the leader of the iron workers. And so I think this strike really sort of showed the way in which the, you know, the CP had come full circle from being this crowning achievement of rebuilding the trade unions, of orienting to the militancy, of inspiring workers with a vision of another society that their struggles were an essential part of. They came back to supporting the government, supporting the war, and stifling rank and file initiative. So that's to briefly conclude on the war. So I guess to try and draw the talk to a close, we have to sort of see that the rebuilding of the trade unions, like I said, was the Communist Party's crowning achievement. And I don't think that it can be understated just how important it was in terms of keeping alive unionism and making key gains for the working class. I think it highlights the very important role a determined minority of socialists can play in this rebuilding and transforming of the fortunes of the working class. And you think about the tiny minority of Communist Party supporters that existed at the end of the 1920s and the role that they played in cohering militants within the unions and being able to take on the bosses and actually win in the later part of the Depression. But I think also it leaves a tantalising question about how things could have been different if the Communist Party's politics, if they hadn't had the sort of Stalinist politics, that they'd had an uncompromising opposition to the war throughout, and how they might have been able to harness the war weariness and opposition, you know, and the frustrations with the war that workers experienced towards the end of the war, and how that might have transformed the political situation in Australia. Because in the end, the Communist Party became key to the sort of post-war settlement in Australia, both in terms of establishing the acquiescence of the working class and the end of the war, but also I think establishing things like a sort of left nationalism that was going to be key to you know, some of the sort of political consensus, I guess, of the post-war period. So I think that sort of question remains about what could have been different had the politics of the Communist Party been genuinely revolutionary and committed to opposing imperialism, and they'd maintained that commitment to rank-and-file organising that was the hallmark of their early work in the 1930s. So I'll just leave it there.